moment you have all been waiting for. It's like when you're a kid and you get some piece of mail and it has your name on it. Or if you're an adult and you get a piece of mail that has your name on it, it's the same thing, right? Although when you're an adult, not all mail has the same effect. Some is junk mail. Some is bill mail. Other mail is actually a handwritten note or a package and you don't know what's inside, or it's something that you bought and are looking forward to have. There's this sense of anticipation, what's inside, because from John's perspective, what was inside this scroll was what he was banking his future on. He was suffering for Christ. He was pastoring and shepherding other Christians to suffer for Christ, to go through extreme hardships for their faith, knowing that what was in this scroll would make it worth it all. And when Jesus was able to open this scroll, he was about to see what it was he was waiting for. Now, this scroll reveals to us a three-stage series of judgments. Each of these stages has a set of judgments in them. Seven judgments per stage. And you string them together and you have the tribulation period. In our study of the book of Revelation, I don't want to obsess too much over building charts that have so many lines and pictures and symbols and words on them that it gets confusing. I want us to read this book as a book, as a narrative that flows as if you were reading a letter. And yet, we do need to organize what we're reading in a way that helps us to visualize some of the things that are going on. And so we will attempt to do that. The chart that you see on the screen right now is one step in helping us visualize the book of Revelation. There's a lot of things I could put on this chart, but here's what I want you to visualize tonight, at least. And we'll add to this a little bit over time. What we are looking at is a three-stage series of judgments. The first, and this is from the zoomed-out, wide-lens perspective of the section of Revelation, we'll say, is from Revelation 6 to Revelation 18. That's the space that we're looking at, Revelation 6 to 18. What we see here is the first stage of judgments are a set of seven seals that are broken, that are popped open on the side of the scroll as it. And we read about these seals in Revelation 6:1 to 8:1. Then, the middle set of judgments is actually a series or set of seven trumpets that are blown by angels. We go from silent seals being broken to this loud blare of trumpets that will be blown by seven angels. Revelation 8:2 to 14:20. And each of the trumpets, when they're blown, mark off the beginning of a new judgment that is unleashed. And then the final set of judgments are seven bowls that are dumped, poured out. It's like when a kid is eating Cocoa Puffs for breakfast. They eat all the Cocoa Puffs out, and then they drink all that chocolatey milk out too, until the bowl is laying on top of their face and they're looking up from the bottom of it, because they want to get every drop of milk out. And that's the idea. We go from these silent seals being opened to these trumpets being blown to the bowls of God's wrath, as it were, being poured out to the last drop until all of his justice and wrath and judgment have been fulfilled. Now, as we study this three-stage series, three sets of judgments, there are several things that I want us to understand. First of all, they happen in a chronological order. They happen in the order that John describes them. Seal number one happens, and then seal number two happens, and then seal number three. In that sense, it's chronological. Also, the judgments, generally speaking, if you can measure this, they actually happen with a observable degree of increased size, magnitude, and severity. And you'll get that sense as we study the judgments. They get kind of worse and worse, as it were. It's as though God's wrath becomes more intense. And I've tried to visualize that on the picture by beginning with the seals being a more warm yellow to an orange to a red, increasing the intensity and the magnitude, the severity. It's interesting that when we talk about these judgments that are described, Matthew 24, and we'll talk about this again, Matthew 24 and 25 is a part of Jesus' teaching ministry that also foreshadowed some of these events. And he describes these things as labor pains. When a lady is pregnant, she has a long period of quiet. You could add suffering. There are things that happen as she prepares in the first term, the second term, that prepare for this baby to be born. But the due date of her baby, the more intense things become, the more severe, the more painful. And yes, sometimes these things even overlap. And eventually, things happen so quickly you can't even catch a breath in between, though before there were weeks and months between events. Matthew 24 and verse 8 describes this period of time as birth pains. These judgments increase in magnitude and severity. They overlap, and I've tried to show this as well. If you can visualize this, we'll refer to this fact when we come up to these moments in the series and sequence of judgments, but I'll foreshadow. The first seven seals lay out one after another. But when we get to the end of Revelation 6, we'll realize we only saw or read about six seals. Revelation 7 tells us some things, and then Revelation 8 introduces us to the seventh seal. That's when Christ breaks the last seal on the scroll. You say, what is the seventh seal? The seventh seal is the seven trumpets. It's seven judgments. Seal one is a judgment. Two is a judgment. Three is a judgment. Four, five, six. But seal seven is a seven judgments bundled into one, the trumpet judgments. Then what we'll notice is that trumpet one will be blown, a judgment will be unleashed. Two, three, four, five, six trumpets will be blown, six judgments will be unleashed. And then when the seventh trumpet is blown, what is the judgment unleashed in the seventh trumpet? Can you guess? Seven bowls will be unveiled to be poured out. And that's what I mean by these overlap. The seventh seal is the seven trumpets. There is a sense in which the seventh seal covers all the way to the end of the tribulation because it includes the seven trumpets. The seventh trumpet includes the seven bowls. There's this telescopic overlapping effect. And if a lady has given birth and experienced birth pangs, I imagine she would understand what this kind of overlapping can be like. It gets very intense. There's also a sense in which the time that elapses between the initial judgments is a little longer, and that time decreases between as you narrow down to the end. Between each set, so the seven seals, the seven trumpets, the seven bowls, the book of Revelation doesn't do it quite so neatly and rapidly as giving us seven of one, then seven of the next, then seven of the next. There are some interruptions. If we were watching a movie, we would call them intermissions. But these are no times to go and grab popcorn. These intermissions have different purposes. They serve as parenthetic material. As you notice, I already told you that Revelation 6 will give us a series of six seal judgments. Revelation 7 will be an interruption. Revelation 8 will get back to business and tell us about seal number 8. And you will notice that there will be interruptions like this interspersed throughout and in the middle, not just in between, but also within each set of judgments. These inserted materials give us kind of this behind-the-scenes info to help understand a little bit more of what's going on behind the curtain of these judgments, or to help us better understand the significance of what's happening, to give us more in-depth perspective on what we're seeing unfold. We also need to realize that this series of judgments encompasses a period of time in the future that we call, the Bible calls, the tribulation. This is a period of 7 years. We're not going to study in depth at this point Daniel chapter 9. But Daniel chapter 9 is a prophecy that God gave to the prophet Daniel about his sovereign plan for the nations of the world. And this sovereign plan we call the 70 weeks prophecy. The 70 weeks prophecy in Daniel chapter 9, end of the chapter, is given, as that prophecy says, to explain what will happen for the nation of Israel, God's holy people, and God's holy city, Jerusalem. It also pertains to how Israel and the rest of the nations will play out as God, and he gives a series of, I think, six things that he wants to do through the 70 weeks plan. Each of the 70 weeks represents 7 years. And if we study the prophecy, what we find out is 69 weeks have already occurred and been interrupted by this period of time of the church. The 70th week remains outstanding. It hasn't happened yet, and it needs to happen for God to finish, to put the finishing touches on the way that he intends to purify his holy nation of Israel, to purge out the wickedness from the nations, to judge them, and so on. It's like refining gold. It needs to go through several stages of heating up to finish the purification process. And the 70 weeks prophecy plan of God's sovereign plan for the nations of the world and Israel is this purging, purification, judging process that he has played out. And the 70th week, the tribulation, a period of 7 years left, must still occur. We also should know, as background, that in the ministry of Jesus, Matthew 24 through 25, Mark 13, and Luke 21, most of that chapter, gives us what we call the Olivet Discourse, a series of teachings by Jesus to his disciples that also says important things that also reappear in the book of Revelation. And so, as we go through this stage of the book of Revelation, we will probably at some times refer back to the 70 weeks prophecy or to the Olivet Discourse and to other places as we understand what is unfolding in this series of three sets of seven overlapping judgments. As we study these judgments, we also need to rest assured that the church, believers functioning in the world today as the church from all nations, will not experience these events. We are not describing anything that is happening right now. We are describing things that will happen once God resumes his plan for the nations and removes the church first. Christ will keep us out of this stage of his divine program, which John identifies as the great day of God's wrath. Now, Revelation chapter 3 and verse 10. Pastor Chris mentioned this a couple of weeks ago. One of the promises that Christ gives to churches, to genuine believers whose faith is demonstrated as genuine because they persevere to the end through all manner of trial and suffering. He says, I also will keep you from, and that's a preposition that means out of, from out of the hour of trial, which shall come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth, referring to his process of purging the nations. This process will be played out yet again in the future on the whole world. But those who are faithful, persevering believers, true believers in the church today will be kept out of that situation. Revelation 6:17, we will look at that in a subsequent lesson, describes what we're looking at as the great day of his wrath has come. And who is able to stand, people will say. Revelation 6, this is what's going to happen looking back at the first six seal judgments. Once seal number 6 is unleashed, people of the world are going to look at what they have witnessed and experienced, and they will say, oh, the great wrath of the Lamb has come. And that is a word that refers to what has just happened, not what is getting ready to happen. The exact same phrase is mentioned in Revelation chapter 11 and verse 18. I don't have it on a slide, but this is something that will also be said at the end of the trumpet judgments. Guess what will be said at the end of the next set of judgments? The wrath of the Lamb has come. It's the same thing. Six seal judgments. What is the conclusion? The day of his wrath has come. We just experienced it. The next set of seven. There's more. The great day of his wrath has come. 1 Thessalonians 1:10, stepping just a second out of the book of Revelation, but talking about prophecy, says that believers are to wait for God's Son from heaven, whom he raised from the dead, even Jesus, who delivers us from the wrath to come. That is coming. The coming wrath. He delivers us out from it. But in Revelation, we find, when we read about the seal judgments, that it has come. The tribulation is the great day of God's wrath, and from that day and hour, the church will be preserved and removed. I like 2 Peter chapter 9 as well. Another verse, a book that's given to us to encourage us to persevere through suffering. And it's speaking here of end time events. Judgment. The Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptations. And if you study the context of this, you'll realize he's speaking about end time trials. And to reserve the unjust under punishment for the day of judgment. And if you study that passage, he's referring to the kind of events we're reading about in Revelation. From an Old Testament perspective, referring back to Daniel's 70 weeks prophecy, it's important to remember that the 70 weeks prophecy was given for the nation of Israel, the people of Israel, the city of Jerusalem, and the nations. And the first 69 weeks of that prophecy, that prophetic plan, happened without the church. And so that is why it is very reasonable and sound to assume that the church will also not be present when the plan is perfected. That player that was inserted will be removed and the plan will be resumed. The church has a different function. But when God, this is one of the things we need to realize. A lot of things we experience on earth as believers are not God's wrath. We have not suffered God's wrath yet. We suffer persecution, trials, and suffering. Wrath is when God pours out his anger. And that has not yet been unleashed. So, all of that background being said, I needed to give that to help lead into what we're going to be studying for a little while now. Leads us to the seal judgments themselves. And tonight, we're only going to introduce ourselves to the first four seal judgments. We won't talk about the next three yet. And so here, Christ himself, we have to keep the focus on Christ. He himself is the one that's going to step forward and break these seals. Notice in Revelation 6, I'll read about the first eight verses and introduce us to the first four seal judgments. See what you can pick up. See what's similar between these four seals and what happens, and see what's different. Now I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures saying with a voice like thunder, "Come and see," and I looked and beheld a white horse. He who sat on it, the horse, had a bow, and a crown was given to him that he went out conquering and to conquer. When he opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature saying, "Come and see." And another horse, fiery red, went out. And it was granted to the one who sat on it to take peace from the earth, and that people should kill one another, and there was given to him a great sword. When he opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, "Come and see." So I looked and beheld, and a black horse. Or you could read that as a dark gray horse. And he who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, "A quart of wheat for a denarius, 3 quarts of barley for a denarius. Do not harm the oil and the wine." Verse 7. When he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature saying, "Come and see." So I looked and beheld a pale horse. Or you could read that as a pale greenish horse, sickly green. And the name of him who sat on it was Death, and Hades, or the grave, the underworld, followed with him. And power was given to them over a fourth of the earth to kill with the sword, with hunger, with death, or pestilence, disease, and by the beasts of the earth. Now, we talk about these four seal judgments. We bundle them together before we move on to the other three because they have some very similar features. For instance, first of all, each of these feature the voice of one of the four angelic creatures that we keep seeing, right? These are the worship leaders at the throne. One has the beast face of a lion, and one like an eagle, and one like a person, and one like a lamb or something else. And we don't know which one it is. Apparently, it's not necessary to know which faced creature is doing what. We just know there's variety. But one of these four, and by the time these four seals are opened, all four have made an announcement. Also, we see that each one of these announcements and seals introduces what appears to be a horse galloping onto the scene. Each of the horses is a different color, not necessarily colors of regular horses. Some of them are very interesting colors. The first one is white. The second one is a fiery red, like a flaming horse. And the third is a black or a dark grayish color. And the fourth is a pale, sickly green color. Each color illustrates what the horse represents in each of the judgments. Each horse also has a rider. John never gives a personal identity for each of these riders. He never tells us who they are. He never gives us a person to identify them as. A name, except for kind of one of them. I will look at that. Each of these riders is described generically as, and the one who sat, or one time, he who sat. People have tried to identify these riders because that's what we do in Revelation. We try to figure out as much as we can, but we must be careful not to say more than we can. Some suggest that these four riders, or at least the first one, is Christ himself because it resembles how in Revelation 19, Christ will come out from heaven on a white horse conquering. This interpretation, though initially appealing, seems unlikely because, first of all, Christ is opening the seals at this present time. It's a little, even though this is still prophetic literature, it's pushing the boundaries to have Christ break a seal and at the same time come riding out of the scroll that he is opening. Not impossible, but a little unusual. It differentiates the first rider from the other three. John treats all three on an equal level, describes them all with the same description, the one who sat, the one who sat. They're treated unilaterally. Christ is too important in the book of Revelation. He's been elevated too highly. He's too superior compared to any other being, I don't care who they are, to be the one who sat being equal like the other three. There are other major differences as well, such as the crown on top of this rider is a Stephanos crown. But the crown in Revelation 19 is a diadem crown, and it's like he has a lot of diadem crowns in Revelation 19. In this instance, this person has one. The Stephanos crown is the victor's crown, something you get if you win something. The other is the king of regal authority. There's a difference. This rider carries a bow at his side, whereas Christ in Revelation 19 wields a sword. flaming sword out of his mouth. Some suggest then that this rider is the Antichrist, especially since that is the whole purpose of the Antichrist, right? To kind of be like Christ, but to fall short. To be a little more appealing, perhaps, but is still unlikely because it seems a little much to actually call the Antichrist death. And then to say that the grave follows him wherever he goes. That's stretching the bounds of even this imagery, to call the Antichrist death. It also seems relevant to observe how the dynamics portrayed by these four horsemen resemble the opening events of the tribulation as Christ described. And I gave you some passages here. I won't read them myself. You can look them up yourself. Matthew 24, 4 through 8, and the other references I give in Mark and Luke. If you read them, they resemble very strongly the kind of things that are described in these four seals. Which leads then to this idea that though the Antichrist will be a key player in these events, the riders and their horses don't really give him that attention, but instead personify the major themes and things that are going to happen to open the tribulation period. Personifying key factors and occurrences that will emerge onto the scene as the tribulation begins. Let's take a look at the four seals. The first seal, the white horse, the bow rider, indicates conquest and peace. This rider, John describes as initiating a period of conquest that produces a kind of peace. He mentions a bow without arrows, but a crown that gives us the impression that he won something. He also describes the rider as engaging in a series of military conquests, that's conquering, and to conquer, with the goal of ultimate victory over all. The best way to understand this description is that the tribulation will begin with some kind of subjugation, centralization of the nations of the world. And it will provide a semblance of unification and peace. This peace will probably be gained not by actual bloodshed and violence, but through the diplomacy that results from the threat or possibility of that. Indicated by a bow with no arrows. The threat of warfare leading to diplomatic peace rather than actual warfare. You can already see the kind of potentially shallow, thin kind of peace that's being established. Conquest may be declared, but it's not very strong. And as we will see, this will be a short-lived period of peace in the world. The next seal will pop and the peace will drop quickly. The second seal, bloodshed and war, Revelation 6, 3 through 4. Bloodshed and war. This horse that comes out will be a fiery red horse. That's fun to imagine, right? A horse that's flaming red. Fiery. Whatever peace the Antichrist will have achieved in the world will eventually give way to outbreaks of cruel and violent skirmishes and warfare. Notice a fiery red horse went out. Peace was taken then from the earth, whatever peace had been established. And people were killing one another. And this horse had a great sword, a dagger, a fighting sword, violence. This indicates the loss of peace through fighting. With the modern advent of chemical and nuclear warfare, it's not hard to imagine how this could happen. I'm not saying that's a description of nuclear bombs, but the kind of violence, bloodshed, and so on, the killing that people can do towards one another today, certainly is easy to imagine how that kind of thing could be tripped off. With such thin and flimsy means of diplomatic peace, the fierce dagger that is described here indicates an especially great time of violence. The third seal then is broken, which indicates then a wave of famine and scarcity that is depicted by this dark gray, blackish horse. And the result is famine and scarcity. And you can, again, it's not hard to imagine with a kind of thin, flimsy peace and outbreaks of violence in the world that occurs, how you would end up with famine and scarcity when this is all going on worldwide. And there is this set of balance scales that is given to the rider that indicates a need for forced, rationed supplies, necessities. And though there have been all kinds of famines throughout history, none will have happened on this global scale, so universally. After the seal is opened, John hears, this is an interesting thing, I don't know if you noticed this, he hears a voice coming from out of the midst of the throne, and it's not one of the four creatures. And in chapters 4 and 5, best as we know, the only other two voices that could come from that close to the throne are God the Father and God the Son. Which if you look down towards the end of chapter 6, it says the people are going to say, fall on us, hide us from the face of Him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. Which shows their unified front in pouring out these judgments from the throne. John, I don't know if it's the emerald glow of glory or the action that he's witnessing or the activity of the four angelic creatures, but he wasn't sure whether it was the Father or the Son. You ever feel like that when you're studying Scripture? You're not sure if you're hearing from God the Father or the Son sometimes? Well, even John wasn't sure, but it was one of them. Which shows as well that what's being described as famine and scarcity, even in the forced rationing, those happening on a human earthly level, is actually being governed from the throne. God is even intimately involved in that level of what's happening in the world. He is setting the economy, as it were, at this time. And the voice announces severity from this famine, saying, a denarius is one day wages. Whatever an average person would have made in those days in one day of work. For one day of work, you would be able to buy one measure of flour, which would be just the basic necessity. It'd be like getting the rice you need to survive with nothing else. That's it. For one person. But there is a lower quality of food, barley. That would be a lower grade, like an off-brand food. A lower grade of food back at that time, that if you had more than one mouth to feed, you could take the same one day's wage and buy a lower grade food and feed three people. My family, if I was at this period of time, I'd have to decide which five people not to feed every day. That's what's being described. That's the level of scarcity, the kind of soup lines and bread lines that we're talking about here and how it's going to be rationed out. But then it says, but don't touch the oil and the wine. The best thing I can say about this is that it really seems what's being described is a great disparity between the poor majority and the wealthy class. At this time, there is still a wealthy class that is going to continue to have what they want of their luxury items. There will be a market for that, but it will be reserved. Not hard to imagine that, is it? Then the fourth seal breaks, the fourth in this set. Widespread death is what we read happens next. It says, when he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature say, come and see. So I looked and behold, a pale green horse. Imagine a horse with his ribs sticking out, looking green like he's about to... I'm not going to finish that description. That's the idea. And there's someone riding this horse, poor rider. And following behind the horse is the gateway to the underworld, the undertaker, the hearse, the burial plot is right there. They're working so close together. There's a lot of corpses. That's the idea. And they're being buried or piling up at a rapid rate. Notice what it says. The name of him who sat on it was Death. Hades followed with him. And power was given to them over a fourth of the earth, which means God is going to cap death at 25% of earth's population. I have not taken the time this week to compare how many people have died due to the COVID pandemic. But I did take time to do this math. If the rapture occurred this week and the tribulation began, the seals started popping a week from now, we are at about 7.8 million people inhabiting planet Earth today. It's probably a little high beyond that, but that's the estimate from this year sometime. Let's say it's 8 million or billion. What's happening here? By the fourth seal, we're just talking the fourth seal, 2 billion of the 8 billion will have died. And if the killing and the famine hasn't killed them yet, notice what it says. Here are the four main ways that people will die. The sword, that's already been described. But the fact that it's being mentioned here again means either A, it hasn't stopped, the killing and the violence hasn't stopped, or it's going to flare up again. Number two, hunger, famine. If it hadn't stopped, it's going to flare up again. It's still going to be a factor. Number three, though, death, a word which means pestilence, referring to things like pandemics, diseases, outbreaks. And fourth, the most interesting perhaps, the beasts of the earth. I don't know that any commentator actually knows what this is fully describing, but we do know that animals are going to have an important part in killing people. It's possible that this could be referring somehow to wild animals like bears and lions, alligators and snakes going into residential areas. Maybe in India, that's not so hard to imagine right now. Jaguars creep into the cities right now as it is. But that may happen on a more elevated scale and people may deal with issues of that kind. Or perhaps what this is speaking about is other wild animals like cats and dogs and rats and mice and squirrels and raccoons becoming rabid and being themselves sickened by disease and the effects of that, whether through animal bites or whatever stings, or just spreading their disease because of scarcity, drawing them into places where people live and infecting the food sources and water sources, these kind of things. Or maybe it's just all of that to some degree. Somehow or another, animals will be the source of death. Direct or carriers, I don't know. But that's also going to be a problem. And it's going to be hard to solve because solving the other problems will already be a problem. Imagine us right now during the final stages of COVID, Lord willing, something like this happening. All the animals going rabid in the city. That would be very difficult to handle, especially if you were in the middle of nuclear war. And so we are just at the fourth of the first seven judgments in the sequence of 21. Technically 19 if you consider the overlapping. And so the final three seals we'll look at least the next two, next Wednesday, Lord willing, which is this new thing. It's different from the first four. We'll transition up to heaven and see the prayers of martyrs at the throne of God. And we'll talk about why that's a judgment. Number six, we'll see a sixth seal breaking, and there's going to be things happening, fantastical things, in the solar system and on Earth that will happen all at the same time. And that will bring people to their knees, not to salvation, but to fear. And then the seventh, of course, in chapter 8, will be the introduction of the seven angels who will line up with their seven trumpets ready to blow. Let's close with two key takeaways. As we consider the ominous preview of judgment to come here, we should allow these future events to impact the way we live our lives today. We should, again, see and savor the scene that John shows us. We've talked about some details. We're going to try not to get too nitpicky about some of those things because ultimately I want us to see and savor the scene that John shows us because it's that visualization, that internalization of what we see that is supposed to impact us and give us the strength to persevere. First, we have to ask this question. Have we placed our faith in Christ as Redeemer? Because if we have not, and He does take the church home and begin this series of judgments, then you will experience these judgments. You will experience the wrath of the Lamb rather than letting Him experience God's wrath for you. The shield of His blood will be removed and you will be exposed to God's wrath in person. That is why now we need to run to the Lamb and depend on Him for salvation from the wrath to come. As pilgrim or Christian in Pilgrim's Progress, fleeing from the wrath to come by running to the cross. And if we say, yes, I have done that, then I have to ask this question. Does this prophecy cause peace and perseverance in our lives? If we followed Christ as Savior and Lord, we know we're on the right side of history and we're on the right side of the future as well. That means that no matter what happens in the world, whatever happens, including a week from now, God is still on His throne. The kings of the earth are still nothing compared to Him. And when it's all said and done, they will be addressed by the opening of a scroll. And the judgments that are ordered from the throne, whether it's the Father or the Son or the both of them, they have everything under control. Even when the Antichrist emerges, which has not happened yet, he is not sitting in the White House, he is not sitting in Rome, probably. We don't know who this guy is. We don't know. But even when he shows up, we won't be here for that, but even when he does and begins his activities, though it will appear that he's pulling off the impossible, unifying the world and preparing the stage against God, that itself will be shallow and short-lived. Even on that scale, no matter how greatly we suffer as Christians in this godless age, no matter what happens in the next week or two, we should still expect to suffer for Christ. And what happens in our politics shouldn't change our view of that. we should still have the wind at our backs and the flame of God in our hearts, pushing forward with the gospel, because it is our responsibility not only to lay our head in peace on our bed at night and to persevere through our suffering, come whatever happens. It is our job to motivate, to persuade through love and witness those who will be exposed to this wrath before it comes. We should stop worrying about ourselves and our own safety, and we should be praying and laboring and working for the salvation of those who have not yet been redeemed. We should not be in a panic about that. We should not be all worked up about that. We should be at peace and persevering in those things. Brother Christian is going to really be focusing on outreach in the months and the year ahead. And you're going to hear more about that as we get closer. COVID has held us back a little bit on that. Outreach is important. And when we read about things like this, it should put a desire in our hearts to do that, to save people from the wrath to come.